In September of 1991, I went to Atlanta to give a speech just a few weeks before I was going to formally announce that I was running for president. And after the talk, the then governor of Georgia, Zell Miller, invited me over to the governor's mansion. And I was pleased because I really liked Zell and Shirley Miller, and we stayed up half the night talking about policy, politics, you name it. Right before I left, Zell said he'd support me, and then he gave me two important pieces of advice. He said, on the campaign trail, I'd have to give a lot shorter speeches than the one he'd seen earlier that night. And the second thing he said is, if I wanted to win, I needed to hire this up-and-coming duo of campaign strategists who'd helped him get elected the year before, James Carville and Paul Begala. I didn't always take the first bit of advice, but I'll always be grateful that I did take the second part. I arranged a meeting with James and Paul and came away not only with two of the brightest political minds in America, but two of the best friends I've made. So why am I telling you this? Because politics is about people and the future. And if you want to be successful, you have to have a vision and a message that allows everybody to see themselves as an important part of our shared future. James and Paul are as good at crafting those kinds of messages as anyone I've ever met, because they do care about people and they are interested in their lives and stories. In my 1992 campaign, they helped us to develop a strategy that focused on issues that resonated with voters across every demographic, building an inclusive economy where everyone could share fairly in our prosperity, expanding access to quality, affordable health care, providing family and medical leave, investing in and improving education at every level, and opening the doors of college to all, and protecting our natural resources for our children's future. Now, I know the political and media landscape are constantly changing, but human nature hasn't changed very much, which is why, after countless campaigns and news cycles, James and Paul are still two of the most sought-after strategists and commentators. And even though I'm not running for anything anymore, I still pick up the phone and call them all the time just to get their take on things. So James, Paul, thanks so much for being here.
I'll tell you one thing, that the recording is going to be in my family thing, so I want my great-grandchildren to hear that. I'm going to be just blunt. I loved every word of it, Mr. President.
Play it for my mother. That's it. my children would enjoy it. My mother would believe it. So,
well, first, before I met you, how did you guys meet each other, and what were your first impressions of each other, and how did you decide to work together?
I'll take that one. We met the Tuesday after Labor Day of 1983 when I came to Austin. I think at the behest of Jack Martin, to work for Lloyd Doggett, and Paul was in the room, and it was on his meeting. Then it's 10 minutes into the meeting, I said to myself, I'm not going anywhere again without this guy. And, you know, I never did. And I got to tell you, it was the best judgment call I ever made in my life.
Well, that's very kind, James. I was the gopher who picked James up at the airport. It was Lloyd Doggett, runner for U.S. Senate. He was my state senator and mentor. And they sent me, the lowest man on the totem pole, to go pick up this out-of-state campaign manager. Of course, you know, Louisiana and Texas, they, you can't bring a Louisiana guy in to run a Texas campaign. Are you kidding? But Jack, who we all three know quite well, believed it, had heard of James, believed in him. Doggett took the meeting. I picked up James at the airport. Same thing. I thought, this is the smartest guy I've ever met in my life, but he's too crazy for Lloyd to hire. Lloyd's very straight-laced. And Mr. President, you probably haven't noticed this, but James can tend toward the profane and eccentric. Lloyd, very straight-laced. And I thought, well, Lloyd will never hire this guy, but I'm going to glean everything I can from him before they send him back across the Red River. And I've been trailing in his wake ever since.
Not anymore. Paul was working on the Clarksdale pottery list.
There's one thing I know that you do share in common, and that's the love of politics. But how did you decide to make it a career? And who were your main influences as you grew up and made that decision?
I think main influences I grew up in Louisiana, and I've worked in some campaigns there. Maybe Peter Hart and Mark Shields, who consulted on a 1979 governor's race in Louisiana that I worked on. We got 9.8% of the vote. But the basic concepts, and then I actually learned a lot in 1984 in Texas, because Phil Gramm taught me a lot and beat the crap out of us. But you can say what you want about Phil Gramm. He knew how to communicate. And this, you know, it's a good lesson when you get the crap beat out of you. I think by 85, 86, I would say I was a much better political operative in 1986. I mean, much better than I was in 1981.
Paul?
Yeah, you know, I'd always been a little kind of student activist. I was in student council and student body president in high school, and then I wound up student body president in college. And it was a couple of people. Lloyd was my state senator, and he'd been student body president. And so he kind of took me under his wing and offered me an internship in his state senate office. During a legislative session, oh my God, I hardly went to class, but I got a graduate degree in practical politics in the Texas legislature working interning for Lloyd Doggett. Then he decided he wanted to run for U.S. Senate and brought me on. But before that, he was up for re-election. I forgot this. And his campaign manager was a buddy of ours, Russ Tidwell. And a big real estate guy was running against Lloyd, was going to self-fund. And he took a hard look at it, realized he couldn't win, and dropped out of the race. Well, I was in the headquarters, and Doggett and Tidwell are dancing. They're so happy because now Lloyd's unopposed. And I sat in a corner, and I was on the verge of tears. And Tidwell came over and said, "McGalla, what's the matter with you?" I said, "Well, I just lost the only job I'll ever get in politics, Russ. I mean, who else is going to hire me?" And he said, "As long as you can walk and chew gum, somebody in politics will hire you." It proved to be prophetic. But that's the life for me.
Well, I've been wanting to ask you this for a long time. Tell me something that happened during the 92 campaign that I did not know about.
All right, let me go first here. I almost jinxed us, Mr. President, when we were on the Georgia bus tour, and we're going through South Georgia. And, you know, we spent the night in Valdosta, I remember. We stopped in Columbus, where James Carville was born, called him from there. His father was at Fort Benning in the Army when James was born. But we stopped in Parrott, Georgia, which is a town at the time of 140 souls, not any bigger today. And it's about 70-30 white and black. And you drew a crowd in Parrott, Georgia, that was over 10 times the size of the town. And it was as representative as the town, but, you know, 70-30 white, black. And Zell was with us, Governor Miller. Sam Nunn was with us. I mean, Pierre Howard, the lieutenant governor, great guy, was with us. And you just gave such a great talk. And you talked about mudcats and moon pies, and everybody was nodding, and everybody knew you were one of them. And we spent the night in a motel in Valdosta, and I called George Stephanopoulos. And this is really verboten in a campaign. I would have never told you this, but I said, "George, we're going to win. This is September. We're a long way from home." And I said, we're going to win this thing. And he said, "What makes you think that?" And I told him what I had just seen, having worked for Zell. "So you're in Terrell County, Georgia. By the way, you got 56% there, sir." You ran up the score. And I just said, if this man can draw a crowd like that in a tiny little cotton town like Parrott, Georgia. And the message there really was, I care about you. I give a damn about you. And those folks got it. And so I know that was a jinx, sir, but I did. I felt like this thing was over when you turned in a performance like that in a place like that.
God, I wish I'd known it in September.
I guess it would have the morning phone call, and if I'm not saying anything people don't know, you're not exactly a morning person. And so it sort of goes through the day, and of course it was like on a speakerphone, and you could be quite irritable, and people would say, "Well," I said, "just give it an hour. It's like a thunderstorm that comes through Little Rock. It you got a big rain burst, and then the sun comes out." So I always had to explain to the campaign staff that you were a different person in the afternoon and the morning. So I guess I said that behind your back.
Well, D.G. Wilhelm, who traveled with us, who's now a very successful lawyer, but she used to she's the most cheerful person in the world, best person you could travel with. And James, we would, even D.G., we'd trash you behind your back, you and George, all the headquarters people, Because we were on the plane. We had the most fun. We had the greatest job in the world. You guys were doing all the hard work, but that's not how we saw it at the time. It'd be like 8 or 9 at night, and DG would say, well, James and George and them are on their second cocktail, and we only have 5 more hours left in our working day. So there was that tension back and forth. There is in every campaign. But I think, seriously, Mr. President, the fact that you had that amazingly talented war room with everybody from Gene Sperling, Michael Waldman, Mike Donlan, who's now a top aide to President Biden, and James and George, they did keep us afloat. And I feel a little guilty, James, that we were resentful of the fact that you got to sleep in the same bed every night.
Yeah, I was. We were those. George and I even drinks with Hunter Thompson and P.J. O'Rourke.
And I apologize for my early morning irritability. I was always a workaholic, and I kept going late at night, and my mind would kick in. So it took me a while to get going in the daytime, and I thank you for forgiving me. James, when in our war room, you famously wrote those three memorable lines, change versus more of the same, the economy stupid, and don't forget health care. If you were working in a presidential campaign today or anticipating one in 2024, what would you write on the wall?
Not much different. And health care, it seems to me today, health care and the economy, to 85% of the country, if we go and you get an EKG and you look at your 401k, you view that as two separate events. Most people view it as the same event, that their economic situation is directly tied to their health care. I mean, how many, people that get a toothache that, wait for a toothache before they go to the dentist? We've heard in focus groups, and you still hear it today, I'm one disease away from bankruptcy. I'm one health event. So if I was running in 2024, and it was a Democrat, I probably wouldn't run on change because we would have had Democratic rule for 4 years. But I think the two are as salient today as there's ever been. And I'm such a fanatic on climate because I think it's just such a gut-wrenching. I think the two biggest issues we face are inequality and climate. Now, inequality you can put in as part of your economic message, but I think it's a huge enough issue. I know it doesn't rally a lot, as many people as we would like, but I just think it, on a personal level, it's just too big of an issue to ignore.
We'll be right back. I think we do have to make climate change an economic issue for people, and I think President Biden is trying to do that. And they put some significant amount of money into this American Recovery Act. But one of the problems that we have, and I think has led to a lot of the cultural alienation in the heartland, is that we know that this economy is very uneven geographically and therefore electorally. And I've always believed, having grown up in Arkansas when I was born, our economy was just barely over half the national average, about 54%. But I didn't know anybody didn't have work and who didn't believe they couldn't improve their situation. And that's what kills people is stagnation. If you look up in the mirror every day and you think every tomorrow is going to be like yesterday and you're not going to be able to take care of your kids and you feel insecure about things like healthcare. And we have to find a way, it seems to me, to talk to people together again and to be more welcoming and to deal with the aspirations of ordinary people. And the problem I see is that when we get into, demonizing one another, it may benefit us in terms of turnout in local elections. It may help our progressives in primaries, but it causes real challenges when you get out there in the heartland. There's a great column in the New York Times on the day that we're recording this about how the biggest gains the Republicans made in the entire country between 2016 and 2020 were in Texas, south of San Antonio. We did okay in San Antonio and Bexar County, and then you go further south into the small towns and rural areas, which were heavily Latino, Mexican-American, and we barely escaped with a victory. So what's your take on that? How much has the country changed since our campaign way back in 92? And do you think what Biden's doing now is helping us get back together a little?
If I can start on that, James. This is my favorite political statistic, Mr. President. When, of course, George Washington gets elected in 1788, 100% of the voters are white. In fact, there weren't even voters, who were just electors. But it was 100% white, because we know why. 204 years later, you get elected. Now, we've had the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 19th Amendments. We've had the Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act. It's a completely different country. But guess what? That 100% had only dropped to 87. The time from your election to Joe Biden's, that 87 has dropped to 67. So you have had more demographic change, more dilution in the white vote in the last 28 years than the previous 204. And I think how you react to that, particularly white people, kind of determines which way you're going. For people on this, in this interview, we think it's wonderful. We think that this richness of diversity makes us younger, smarter, more able to compete, interesting, better food, better. My doctor is from Iran. My dentist is from Brazil. My neighbor across the street was a boat person from Vietnam, graduated top of her class at UVA. I look at this as a win-win-win. This is just wonderful. And as James likes to say, I like being in a country people want to come to. I like it. Nobody's busting down the doors to get into Russia. So I think that's terrific. But there's a whole lot of people who don't. And economic stagnation, certainly in a lot of urban areas, but principally or terribly in rural areas. You put all that together, and that's a tinderbox that somebody can come in and demagogue. And I put most of the blame on the demagogues, but some of it is on us too. Is that when we don't acknowledge their pain, when we're losing over 40,000 people a year to opioid addiction, some in the suburbs, some in the cities, but a whole lot in the rural areas, when we don't give voice to that and respect that and listen to it and speak to it and acknowledge it, they're going to be heard. And they're going to turn toward a wrecking ball. And I think that what President Biden is doing is exactly right.
Well, in 1992, there are 3,100 plus county equivalents in the United States. In 1992, 96 were what are referred to as supermajority counties. That is, one of party won by more than 50%. In other words, it won by 75-25. And by 2020, it's probably over 1,300. So there are people in North Philadelphia that don't know a Republican. There are millions of people in rural America that don't know a Democrat. And the geographic separation, I think, has been profound. We went at 1988, when Paul and I were running in New Jersey, I looked it up. Bush 41 won by 8, and Lautenberg won by 8. That doesn't exist anymore in American politics. So we've had polarization, but geographic polarization, I think, is a significant issue. And I being a son of rural America, I totally agree with Paul. And I mean, you were very concentrated on rural America, rural Arkansas. And I mean, if you go to these towns, I took a drive about 2 weeks ago in the kind of northern part of what they call the Florida parishes in Louisiana. And it's just hopeless. It's just, it make you cry to see the lack of any kind of, the biggest employer everywhere is the hospital. I mean, thank God, we saved some of these rural hospitals. But, I mean, you go to Bugalusa or Franklinton or Kentwood, where Britney Spears is from, it is nothing like you remember it. It's really tragic. And they believe, and I think with some validity, I don't think it's insane when they say people have forgotten about us. People don't realize there's a huge swath of Black America that's rural. Okay? you've been to the Arkansas Delta, the Mississippi Delta, even the Louisiana Delta. I mean, we talk like And I think a lot of what hurts our turnout sometimes is they feel like they're left out of the equation. It's not just white America that feels left out.
I was glad when Tom Vilsack agreed to go back and serve as Secretary of Agriculture, because when President Obama was in office, Vilsack he's very low key, he never gets credit for what he's doing. I thought he was the most underrated member of the president's cabinet when Obama was president. He, on his own initiative, because he understood rural America, went out and talked to all these Republican congressmen and convinced them to support the Democrats and allowing him to consolidate a lot of these smaller grants that are given by Congress to the Department of Agriculture into development funds. And the Agriculture Department actually did create, when Obama was president, 250,000 jobs in tiny places. And I think it's really important, because we can only win in the end, over the long run, by having people feel comfortable enough in the growing diversity of America that they don't do what's happening now. So our only option is what the president is doing, for the right reasons, not for this reason, his performance. And we do have, on economic issues, a unity in the Democrats, it seems to me, from our centrist to the left right now, that he had to go big on this first Recovery Act. And we didn't have to deal with the filibuster. And none of the Republicans voted for it, but it was the right thing to do. When you're still 7 million jobs short, and you got this huge hole in the economy, and the GDP dropped like 10 or 15%, it seems to me he did the right thing. But we need to know that we got a long way to go before people think we give a roof about him again.
I do think this president's doing a good job of that. He's not as partisan as I am, thank God. But he is trying to explain to people that these votes have consequences, and that $1,400 in your bank account was opposed by every living, breathing Republican in the House and every living, breathing Republican in the Senate, which is pretty extraordinary.
We have a giant, unsolvable problem. And I'll tell you what's not gerrymandered: the United States Senate. All right? 18% of the voters in the United States elect 52 senators. There has been academic research on the weighted value. That gives enhanced power to rural whites. I hate to say that, but it is just the truth. And a lot of people say, well, that can change. No, it's not going to change. Wyoming is not going to vote, or North Dakota are not going to vote their way out of power. All right, that's just simply not going to happen. It looks like that's a non-ender. So we don't have any choice. We have no choice. If you want power, you have no choice but to engage. Because if you don't, you're not going to have any power.
Well, how much do you think the changes in how people get their information has driven us apart and will continue to do so?
If you think the Senate is a tough and insoluble problem, this is bigger. You always used to teach all of us, but to your staff, that you got to start with an agreed upon set of facts. And that requires you to open your mind that maybe sometimes the other side might have some facts that are relevant, interesting, important, and correct. That's not taught anymore by their political leaders. And you can make a lot of money lying to people, a whole lot, because of market segmentation. Having now spent a couple of decades in cable news. And two, the algorithm in social media is so powerful and so negative. And I don't know what's all in the black box. I don't know if it's ever been publicly disclosed. But here's a good little example, Mr. President. Lent this year, I'm a faithful Catholic, and my wife, Sunday school teacher, challenged me. I always give up cursing, drinking, or Twitter, the three great sins of my daily life. This year, she challenged me. She said, no, do something good, positive on Twitter every single day. And so every single day, between Ash Wednesday and Easter Sunday, every single day, I posted a tweet that began with three words: people are good. And then I explained a link. I linked to a positive story, a Girl Scout troop that formed itself in a homeless shelter in Des Moines and then set the state record for cookie sales, right? Stuff like that. Kids who chipped in to buy their janitor a car when he was out of work because the school had closed. Every single day I did that. Now, when I tweet something mean about the Republicans, thousands, sometimes tens of thousands, 50,000 people may like it. I rarely got 100 people to like any positive thing I did. And it's not that people are bad. It's that the algorithm is. One of my dear friends is Bill Burton, was President Obama's spokesman. And we talk all the time and we follow each other on Twitter. And I mentioned this to him. He said, I've never seen a one of your positive tweets, not a one. And I said, how can that be? And he said, the algorithm doesn't kick it up to me. It doesn't promote it. It doesn't say, hey, Bill, here's your buddy Magala. Now, if I write something hateful, boy, it'll hit him right. So our information platforms now are designed to drive us into division and darkness. And I don't know what to do about that.
We'll be right back. I know that, look, politics has always been a contact sport, and people are always trying to rewrite history. But I do think that there are things that make me optimistic, and one of them is that there is a real unity in the Democratic Party, that at least at this time, the only option is to have a very active government taking a vigorous role to fill a hole in the economy. And so I think, and the thing I like about what Biden's doing is there's enough money in there to, as you pointed out, give the $1,400 check and some of the other support programs, but there's also investment that will create jobs and have a good multiplier. It's not trickle-down economics. And I think we have to hope that if people feel a sense of mobility, that they hope that they feel like we're going places together, that it will dilute the identity wars. But I also think we should go knocking on the other doors. And we ought to look like we're having a good time doing it. It's all, you know, we shouldn't be out there making people think this is about destruction. They win those fights. We were in the people business in 92, and we need to be in the people business and the future business. And, you know, we're not going to melt those icebergs overnight, but before we finish, just give us you guys say a couple of things about what makes you optimistic about the future.
Kids. Yeah, I've taught at Georgetown for 20 years. Before that, I taught at University of Georgia for a semester, University of Texas, and I've got four boys in their 20s. So I know hundreds, thousands of 20-somethings. They're the next greatest generation. They're more public interested and public spirited than I was. They're more selfless. And the thing, though, sir, that I try to imbue in them, this is a good thing that they are challenging the system and that they're impatient. But now I'm old. And what I try to tell them is something you taught me, which is you got to be in this for the long haul. And I'm watching this wonderful tension between people outside the system and inside the system, within our own party and within our own government. And if I can take you back, this is one of the more important moments, I think, in my life. April 2nd, 1992. You're at a fundraiser in New York City, raising money for your campaign for president. And in the middle of it, a guy named Bob Rafsky comes up to you. He was a PR guy who became the chief spokesman for ACT UP, which was, I wouldn't say radical, but really, it was pretty radical, AIDS activist group at the time. And he got right in your face and he was screaming at you. Well, he was. He said, we're not so much dying of AIDS as we're dying of 11 years of government neglect, and ascribed that to you. And your response was, I know it hurts. And then you said four words that people always remember. I feel your pain. And our friends of the far right always mocked you for that. But that kind of deep empathy, here's what happened. The next day or two, you met with ACT UP. A few weeks later, you gave a major policy address during a campaign on AIDS. A few months later, you had Bob Hattway, a man who was your environmental advisor, but who was living with AIDS, speak at the convention. First time a Democrat, either convention, had someone with AIDS speaking about AIDS at their convention. You become president, you create the Office of National AIDS Policy, the AIDS Czar Office. You fund it, and you do more for AIDS than it had ever been done in American history. You leave office and you set up what's now the Clinton Health Access Initiative, which is keeping millions and millions and millions of people with HIV alive. So 29 years ago, pain confronted power. And there was a confrontation, but it sparked conscience, but even more important, constancy and commitment. So you've spent 29 years, and poor Mr. Rafsky is gone, and we lost him before we could have these antiretroviral drugs. But, you know, he yelled fire. And you ran for the hose. And society needs both. And I keep trying to tell like my kids and my students that some people are more driven toward being on the outside and pressuring. And I respect that. And we're seeing a lot of that. And it has a good effect. And people like me who are on the inside need to respect that. But vice versa, people on the outside need to understand that when the rally's over, a good leader picks up that pain and translates it into purpose. And that's the whole point of having power. And that gives me huge, because right now those young people are really pressuring the system, and I want them to. I don't always like it, but I respect it. And then, so the people in the power then have to. And if they have a tenth of the constancy and commitment that you've had to these causes of your entire life, then they'll really change the world. But it's not just about a sending out one tweet and thinking you've done something.
So, Mr. President, our mutual friend Alex Karp, the Palantir CEO, tells a story that the Chinese love jazz. And so they got a jazz combo from New Orleans and went to Beijing. And, you know, the big auditorium was just packed. And they played for a couple of hours. And, of course, they rushed the thing to talk to them. And the main thing they wanted to ask was, how did you memorize those notes? All right? That kind of creativity and that kind of energy, what we saw what science do on this vaccine, would you start? I think 100 years from now, your accomplishment will be you stopped the genocide, you left for the surplus, is the best income growth of any president since World War II. But the Human Genome Project, I mean, you walk the walk when we talk about science. You know, everybody's now talking about science is science that. That's the foundational thing. I mean, you're... economies get good and they get bad and things like that happen, but the march of knowledge goes on. And I think the combination of that and the creative genius that people have gives me great hope, but we don't have to memorize the notes.
Yeah, I agree with that. And we need to have some more schools like Berea in Kentucky, where basically you can go for free and they don't have any athletic programs. They don't have any they don't have things that a lot of people think are important for college, but they send undergraduates to every high-powered graduate program in the country. And if you go there, you have to work. You have to help serve dinner and clean buildings and do all this kind of stuff. But it's a community. We need to have enough models here that work more like the community colleges do. You know, I think that are open to everybody and that give everybody some hope. And I hope that one of the things we'll do, I agree with one of you mentioned that one of the best things in Biden's economic plan is finally we're going to bring universal affordable broadband to every place in America.
Well, this notion of tying education to service is something you did when you created AmeriCorps. And here's a very positive sign. Chris Coons, who has Joe Biden's old seat in the U.S. Senate from Delaware, Democrat, has partnered with Roger Wicker, who's from Mississippi. He ain't no Democrat, conservative Republican senator. And Senators Coons and Wicker want to take your AmeriCorps, which I believe serves about 75,000 young people a year.
Yeah, I think we're up to 75 now.
And take it to 1 million. I call that a good start.
It would make a huge difference.
Oh, the two things is that, yes, it would give a whole lot of young people a low-cost, debt-free education and skills, which is terrific. It also gives them life skills that they learn as they're serving. But it integrates us. This big sort that we were talking about, that you and James were talking about before, you integrate people. When you have served with them, you know, James, when at their kids' high school, Patrick, they all had to do service. The first three all went to Dominican Republic on their service trips. Patrick wanted to go to Lower Ninth. So he goes to New Orleans and is serving in that community. And of course, the group coming from their school was about half white, half black. And when you serve with people and you serve other people, you can't hate them anymore. Actually, they went over to St. Bernard Parish too, which is, I think, James, predominantly white, right?
It is, yes.
And they did service in the Lower Ninth and then over in St. Bernard. And you can't hate people if you've served with them and you know them. And so it would, I think it would do a lot to stitch the social fabric together. I don't know if President Biden's on board. I imagine he is. I hope he is. But I know that Senators Coons and Wicker, in a bipartisan fashion, are trying to take your idea and bring it to scale.
I got, before we go, my favorite Bill President Clinton story, and I know people do this to you, Paul, do all the time to you, Mr. President, and to me. You said, some people say, what political advice you have from our career? So we were in Little Rock for one of the reunions that we had, and we were all standing in line, and Kaya Andrus, who worked for me in a war room, was actually from Minden, Louisiana, which is a small town in northwest Louisiana, not very far from Arkansas. And she had a daughter, and our daughter was like 14, and you were walking through and shaking hands, being gracious to everybody. And so Kaya looks at you and says, Mr. President, this is my daughter. She's 14. She wants to be president one day. What advice do you have for her? And you kind of cocked your head back and your finger, and it's the best political advice I've ever heard. You said two things. Study hard and meet as many people as you can that are not like you. That's the most profound political advice I've ever heard anyone give a young person. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think we've been blessed, you know, and just meeting people and hearing their stories. It makes it a lot easier to figure out what can be done to make their stories better. And I think, you know, I do a little bit of what Paul was talking about with this leadership program that George W. Bush and I do, where we pick 60 people a year. It's a very diverse group. And they wind up loving each other and loving the fact that they get to work together. And I think part of it is they actually get to know each other as people. The other part is they begin with the end in mind. Whereas, you know, so much of modern political life, not just in America, but everywhere else, doesn't allow you to begin with the end in mind and then work back to what you can honorably compromise on to get there. And for all kinds of obvious reasons. But I'm grateful that, you know, by the time I left office, we'd already had more people in AmeriCorps than had served in the Peace Corps in 40 years. And yet the impact of the Peace Corps on America has been quite profound just because of what people did with their lives when they came back. And I think, you know, this is probably a good place to stop because we're all in a pretty good humor. We're the oldest continuously existing democracy on earth. Periodically, people have worried about us. Even President Eisenhower during the McCarthy era worried about whether we would have the discipline it takes to maintain a free society over the long run. And so far, everybody that's bet against us has lost money. And I just think, you know, we just got to keep growing and going. And I'm hopeful. I think Biden's been pretty much pitch perfect so far. But he's got a big lot of stuff to do. And there are problems. Not every problem has an instantaneous solution. But the American people are pretty smart about that, too. We just got to let this thing play out and keep working. But I thank you guys, and I hope you'll keep your voices out there and keep doing what you've done. I'm very proud of the lives that you've built and the families you've raised, and that we once got a chance to do something to make the country better and help them along their journey.
Well, I love you, Mr. President. Thank you.
I do, too, and it's all because of you that what a turtle on a fence post. We were both put there by you. Thank you.
That's exactly. Yeah. James and I would be pitching a lieutenant governor's race in Kentucky if you hadn't hired us. We'd still be out there hammering away.
Yeah, and if it hadn't been for you guys, I'd still be home doing deeds and $100 divorces, too. So thank you.
Yes, thank sir. You, sir. Thank you very much. It's a big honor. Thank you.
Why Am I Telling You This is a production of iHeartRadio, the Clinton Foundation, and At Will Media. Our executive producers are Craig Manassian and Will Malnati. Our production team includes Mitch Bluestein, Jameson Katsoufis, Tom Galton, Sarah Horowitz, and Jake Young, with production support from Tyler Scott and Latavia Young. Original music by Watt White. Special thanks to John Sykes, Tina Flannoy, John Davidson, Angel Urena, Corey Gansley, Oscar Flores, Kevin Thurm, and all our dedicated staff and partners at the Clinton Foundation. If you have an idea or suggestion for the show, we'd love to hear from you. So please visit clintonfoundation.org/podcast to share your thoughts with us. If you like the show, tell someone else about it. You can subscribe to Why Am I Telling You This on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast. By listening to this podcast, you're helping support the work of the Clinton Foundation. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Street, Executive Director of the Clinton Foundation, where we work every single day to advance President Clinton's commitment to public service and improve lives across the country and around the world. President Clinton often reminds us that we're all in this together, that we rise or fall together. That's why, in the face of crisis, we answer the call, we act. At the Clinton Presidential Center, we've been proud to work together with partners to serve hundreds of thousands of meals to those struggling to put food on the table, to get books, early learning and educational resources into the hands of parents, families, and educators who are navigating the realities of remote learning and need it most. And the center continues to serve as an educational and cultural institution focused on cultivating the next generation of leaders to make our future brighter than ever. Learn more about this work and see how you can get involved. Visit www.clintonfoundation.org/podcast.